The 100 Years' War, the Du Guesclin period, the English plans for 1378. During the first few months of the reign of Richard III, the English government, frustrated by the problems of reinforcing Gascony and frightened by the coastal raids of Jean de Vienne, adopted the strategy which was to dominate their conduct of the war with France for the next 10 years. They set about acquiring a chain of garrison fortresses, clones of Calais, along the Atlantic coast of France, Brest, Cherbourg, La Crotoye, and Saint-Malo. Brest and Cherbourg were successfully occupied and held against the French for many years. Two major attempts against Saint-Malo failed. Designs against La Crotoye were abandoned. The Channel Islands, after a long period of neglect by the English crown, were built up as a food center and supply center and a staging post for operations in Normandy and Brittany, developments which had already provoked powerful raids against the island by the French commanders. By 1377, the two major castles of the Channel Islands, Castle Corner on Guernsey and Corry on Jersey, both had substantial garrisons. A future English chancellor would refer to all these places as England's frontiers and barbicans beyond the sea. As the phrase suggests, the authors of English policy thought of the barbican as the first line of defense against French attacks on England. They served as bases from which to control the English Channel. They maximized the threat from English expeditionary army, and now had a choice of places by which to enter France, thereby tying down large French forces in their own country. Whether the scheme was coherently thought out from the beginning or came about by trial and error as opportunities arose is a question which the sources, always fuller on actions than designs, did not directly answer. It was certainly a policy deliberately promoted and to some extent financed by powerful mercantile interests, mainly in London, which had lost heavily by French piracy and naval raids and were keen to reassert English control over the narrow seas. But it also reflected long-standing frustrations among those who were concerned with the fortunes of the land war. The easiest point of entry into France was through Calais and Picardy. The shortest sea crossing required only local command of the sea and could be achieved with relatively modest fleets of transports operating in relays. But England's strategic interests were now concentrated in the Atlantic provinces of Normandy, Brittany, and Gascony, which were difficult to reach from Calais. The lower reaches of the Seine and the Loire, with their broad, fast-flowing streams, represented an impassable barrier for an army. Brittany could be reached from Calais only by taking the long way around, north and east of Paris, as Edward III had done in 1359 and Knowles in 1370, and as the Earl of Buckingham would do in 1380. To reach Gascony, as John of Gaunt learned in 1373, an even more circuitous route was required, through the upper valley of the Loire and the western slopes of the Massif Central. The first objective was Brest and its outlying harbors in western Brittany. The fortress had been held by English garrisons for many years, but its captains were answerable to John de Montfort, who was in principle responsible for paying their wages, maintaining the defenses, and directing operations. In 1377, he was in no position to do any of these things. Certainly before the truce expired, the English government sent an armed escort to collect him from Bruges, where he had been living in exile for the past year, and bring him back to England through Calais. He arrived a ruined man. His only English asset, the honor of Richmond in Yorkshire, was mortgaged to Sir John Neville for security for the great sums which were owed him for his services in the duchy before 1374. Brest and Auray were the only places in Brittany where his flag actually still flew. Neither of them seemed likely to survive long. Auray was besieged by Olivier de Clisson at the beginning of July 1377. English garrison opened their gates to the French within a month and took ship back to England. At Brest, the bastides in front of the gates were already reoccupied by Olivier de Clisson's Breton companies. A squadron of Castilian merchant ships arrived to blockade the harbor. If the English council had not taken swift action, the place would have almost certainly have gone the way of Auray. He paid off part of his debt to Neville, redeemed Richmond, and assumed responsibility for the cost of defending the fortress. In return, Jean de Montfort was obliged to cede the town and the castle and the famous harbor to the English for the duration of the war. A squire, John Clark, was sent out to the town at the beginning of September with supplies, reinforcements, and orders for the garrison. He was to be followed by a large seaborne operation in October. The object was to break the blockade, lift the siege on the landward side, and occupy as much as possible of the territory in westward Finisterre, which had been traditionally controlled from Brest. For shipping, the council proposed to use the fleet which had been assembled in the Thames in June. It was still being held there under requisition, abandoned by its crews and depleted by desertions. A fresh round of requisitions was put in hand to reinforce them. The admirals concentrated on the larger vessels that could be built up for fighting at sea. Press gangs were sent out through the maritime communities to find seamen. Nearly 4,000 of these troops were, shall we say, recruited. The chief figure behind this enterprise was Edward III's youngest son, Thomas of Woodstock, Earl of Buckingham, and Richard Fitzalan, Earl of Arundel, two men who were to be closely associated with the new naval strategy. They had much in common. Arundel had recently succeeded into his father's earldom at the age of 30. Intelligent and ruthless, Arundel was one of the richest men in England, with ambition to match his fortune. Buckingham was to command the expedition in Brest. He was a more enigmatic figure. Only 22 years old at Richard's accession, he hitherto lived in the shadows of the royal court. There is some evidence that the old king thought ill of his abilities. He had been dubbed a knight comparatively late and became an earl only at his nephew's coronation. Although he had been constable of England since 1376, he had acquired no military or political experience at all in his father's time, and never had an endowment to match his status. Yet throughout his life he had a stately manner and strong attachment to the conventions of chivalry and the forms of courtly behavior. He spoke like a king's son, said Froissart. Thomas of Woodstock was perhaps the most extreme example of the young nobleman of his generation, who struggled against the frustrating limitations of English power that deprived them of the chances of glory that their fathers and grandfathers had enjoyed. This frustration was intensified in his case, as it was for so many of his contemporaries. By expensive tastes, a profound sense of lineage, and a perennial shortage of money, the best of men was the chronicler Walsingham's judgment of him. And his career showed him to have been an assertive and quarrelsome man with a high opinion of his own talents, which were never entirely justified by his acts. So that's what the English are going to be planning on doing. Now we have to see if they're going to get the money to do it from the Parliament. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. And ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.